Today is Wednesday, June 13th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Coming up, describing President Trump's strategy on North Korea.
The idea is to try to lure North Korea into an engagement and a sustained investment into this process.
Plus, we take a look at North Korea's human rights. Greece and Macedonia reach an agreement, and the World Cup is about to begin. Is Russia ready? It's all ahead on today's International Edition. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has landed at Osan Air Base south of Seoul, South Korea, ahead of meetings with America's allies after the summit between President Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. VOA's Jeff Custer has the details.
Secretary Pompeo met for close to an hour with General Vincent Brooks, the commander of U.S. Forces Korea. The meeting took place at Osan Air Base before Pompeo headed by motorcade to Seoul. The secretary will meet President Moon Jae-in early Thursday to discuss the summit. In addition, Japanese Foreign Minister Taro Kono is headed to Seoul and is due to meet with Pompeo and his South Korean counterpart. Secretary Pompeo then flies to Beijing to update the Chinese government on the talks. Jeff Custer, VOA News.
U.S. President Donald Trump is back in Washington. He tweeted earlier this morning, "Just landed. A long trip. But everybody can now feel much safer than the day I took office. There is no longer a nuclear threat from North Korea. Meeting with Kim Jong-un was an interesting and very positive experience. North Korea has great potential for the future." King Gauz is director of international affairs at CNA, an Arlington, Virginia-based nonprofit research and analysis organization. He told VOA's Victor Beatty the president has adopted a new strategy that throws out the status quo from the window.
It's what I call the go big or go home strategy. And basically what he has done is he opened the door and rolled out the red carpet for Kim Jong-un to come in. In order for this to work, because you're in an asymmetric relationship between the United States and South Korea, in an asymmetric relationship where you're trying to reach normalization in peacetime as opposed to conflict, the greater power has to make the first concessions in order to give the weaker power the incentive and the confidence to move forward. And I think it was foreshadowed by Pompeo's statements a couple of days ago about giving North Korea the confidence that we would not conduct regime change and that we would provide security for the regime. And I think this is part of that. Basically stopping the military exercises, not going for complete transparent CVID right off the bat, having a phased process. The idea is to try to lure North Korea into an engagement and a sustained investment into this process, and that will hopefully lead North Korea to start to take measures toward denuclearization.
The official KCNA news agency in North Korea ran a glowing dispatch of its first take, if you will, on the Singapore summit, referring to it as epic-making, a radical switchover in the most hostile North Korea-U.S. relations. So that seems to reflect what you're saying.
Exactly, because now what Trump has done, what he has bet the farm on here, is that Kim Jong-un will follow through. It's what I compare an analogy of the turtle on the beach to the shark in the ocean. The turtle on the beach is status quo. The turtle can live for 300 years and maybe move 10 feet. But the shark in the ocean has to keep moving forward. And the moment he stops moving forward, he dies. And that's what this process is all about. Unless North Korea comes through, shows verifiable examples of denuclearization, all of this program that has been set up could fall apart overnight. And the United States will slam the door, lock it, and throw away the key. We're in a brand new world here.
King Gauz said this was not a traditional summit where details are worked out and the leaders meet to sign off on shared objectives, but rather what he called a great leader meeting to get acquainted, make broad statements, and then the details are worked out. The crucial thing, Gauz notes, is for both leaders to stay invested in the process, which he expected to be long and bumpy. Now, speaking in Singapore to VOA contributor Greta Van Susteren, U.S. President Donald Trump said that North Korean leader Kim Jong-un loved his people. I asked Greg Scarlutu, the executive director for the Committee for Human Rights in North Korea, if that was an accurate statement.
We have to remember that diplomacy is a good thing. Summit diplomacy had never been tried before. It's the first time it was tried. It's always a good idea to focus on what the president does rather than what he says. The Kim regime is committing crimes against humanity, against its own people. There are 120,000 men, women, and children being held in political prison camps pursuant to a system of guilt by association called Yeonjaje that punishes up to three generations of the offender's family.
Are there broader implications, not only for those in North Korea, but for other rights abusers around the world, when the president uses such platitudes?
Well, I think that the president is very keen on challenging the status quo, and we have to admit that of all U.S. presidents so far, he is the one who has managed to get some movement on the North Korea issue. Now, moving ahead, the challenge will be to channel this movement. North Korea is a very important precedent, a critical precedent on multiple fronts. This is a regime that is committing crimes against humanity. Will Kim Jong-un be able to get away with crimes against humanity just because he developed nuclear weapons and sat at the same table with a leader of the free world? We're dealing with very serious issues. To the president's credit, he, again, has managed to challenge the status quo and get some movement. But now the big question is, where do we go from here?
We have this closer relationship between North and South Korea, between Kim and Moon Jae-in, between Kim and the President of the United States. We have that very detailed 2014 United Nations Human Rights Council Commission of Inquiry,
yeah,
which details a lot of the crimes against humanity. We have the president saying denuclearization right now is the bigger issue. We're going to address human rights later. So where do we go?
Well, denuclearization has always been the bigger issue. And human rights organizations are very used to this predicament, where human rights is sacrificed on the altar of negotiating the nuclear or the missile issue. For 30 years now, multiple administrations have basically sacrificed the human rights issue. So this is the same predicament, the same mistake made by previous administrations. Let us all hope that this administration is different. I will say one thing. We do not trust the North Korean regime for very good reasons. Again, it has breached each and every international agreement it's had. The president said that he had raised human rights with Kim Jong-un, and if that is the case, that is a positive development. I hope we will find out more about the nature of the discussion they had on human rights and the issues that he raised.
Greg Scolaartu is the executive director for the Committee for Human Rights in North Korea. Here are more of the top stories from around the globe. The head of the World Health Organization cautioned against declaring victory too early in Congo's Ebola epidemic, despite encouraging signs that it may be brought under control. The leader of Afghanistan's Taliban renewed his call for direct talks with the United States to end the war. That dashed hopes the insurgent group might engage in peace talks with the Kabul government. Iranian President Hassan Rouhani says it will be difficult for Tehran to stay in the 2015 nuclear accord it signed with world powers if it cannot benefit from the agreement. For expanded coverage to these stories and more, visit voanews.com or download our mobile application to take the stories with you. This is International Edition.
This is Science in a Minute.
Researchers say they have discovered the remains of the formation of the solar system in some interplanetary dust. The dust particles that were found in Earth's atmosphere are thought to be cast off from comets as they pass Earth on their way to the sun. Using electron microscopy, the scientists noticed the tiny grains of dust are made up of other even smaller grains that fused together in a different environment before the comet was formed. The researchers note that the dust particles appear to have formed in a cold, radiation-rich environment, such as what would have been found in an outer solar nebula or pre-solar molecular cloud. Research leader Hope Ishii from the University of Hawaii says that her team's observations suggest that their discovery represents surviving pre-solar interstellar dust that formed the very building blocks of planets and stars. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Greece and Macedonia have reached an historic accord to resolve a dispute over the former Yugoslav Republic's name that has troubled relations between the two neighbors for decades. Reuters' Scarlett Vitanović has that story.
For over 27 years, Greece and Macedonia have battled over the latter's name. Now the neighbors have reached an historic accord to resolve the dispute. It paves the way for Macedonia to become a member of the European Union and NATO.
They have agreed to change their constitutional name for all purposes. They agreed to rename their country as Republic of North Macedonia.
Ever since the small Balkan state broke away from Yugoslavia in 1991, its name has soured relations between the pair. Greece has its own territory called Macedonia, and says the name implies a territorial claim over Greek land. The case also angers Greeks who consider the ancient Kingdom of Macedonia, ruled over by Alexander the Great, to be an integral part of their heritage.
Macedonia is Greek. It has nothing to do with the citizens of Skopje. They came here in the 6th century. They don't have anything to do with Macedonia. I'm sorry.
Currently at the United Nations, Macedonia is formally called the former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia. If the new name is ratified by both countries' parliaments, it's expected to clear the path for it to become a member of the European Union and NATO, something Greece had always vetoed.
After the ratification, the Republic of Greece will send a letter to the NATO Secretary General, informing him that there is no longer a dispute between the two countries, and there are no obstacles for Macedonia to receive an invitation to NATO membership.
Both countries' prime ministers will need to face down opposition over the agreement, and the change also needs to be approved by the Macedonian people in a referendum.
That was Reuters reporter Scarlett Vitanović. The most widely used antimalarial drug may fall short for children and pregnant women, according to a new study. Researchers found these patients' bloodstreams contained lower than average concentrations of one of the active ingredients. Their research may explain why standard treatment sometimes fails to cure these sensitive groups. VOA's Steve Barragona has more.
Malaria cases are down 60% since 2000, thanks to multi-billion dollar global efforts. But the battle is not over, says Frank Kloperga at University College London.
More than 400,000 people are killed every year by malaria, and actually most of them are small children below 5 years of age in the sub-Saharan regions in Africa.
The best, most widely used treatment is a 3-day course of pills combining two drugs, artemether and lumefantrine. But most drug trials have not included children and pregnant women, who may absorb or metabolize medicines differently. Kloperga says children have different levels of key enzymes, for example.
Pregnant women also have changes in body composition. You can think about water and fat content. And this also has an impact on how the drug distributes through the body.
Some studies have found children and pregnant women are more likely than others to develop malaria again within weeks of treatment. Writing in the journal PLOS Medicine, Kloperga and colleagues combined data from 31 studies, which included more than 4,000 patients. They looked at blood levels of lumefantrine 7 days after treatment began.
Pregnant women were, for example, 20% lower, and depending on the body weight group in children, it was somewhere between 15 and 25% lower.
He says that raises the risk not only that treatment will fail, but also that resistance will develop. Malaria parasites exposed to lower levels of the drug may survive treatment and produce resistant strains. Kloperga and colleagues developed a model that suggests taking the pills for 5 days would be more effective than the current 3-day schedule. It's an important, well-done study, says Andrea Bosman, malaria prevention, diagnosis, and treatment coordinator at the World Health Organization. However, he adds,
it is still a modeling study, and we do not generally make recommendations based on modeling studies alone. We require clinical data.
And Bosman says longer treatment carries its own risks.
It has a downfall in terms of adherence to treatment, because the more you ask the people to take, the less becomes the compliance.
Less compliance means more treatment failure and more risk of resistance. Other studies have not concluded that changing treatment is necessary. Klopurgo and colleagues are applying for funding to conduct a clinical trial of the 5-day treatment schedule. It'll be several years before results are in. Steve Barragona, VOA News, Washington.
This is International Edition.
Sporty greetings to all our VOA listeners. This is Sonny Young, host of The Sunny Side of Sports. Please join me at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC, Monday through Friday, for special World Cup updates during the month-long football festival in Russia, right here on The Voice of America.
Hey, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
From the Voice of America, this is International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. North America will host the 2026 World Cup after FIFA voters overwhelmingly opted for the financial and logistical certainty of a United States-led bid over a risky Moroccan proposal for the first 48-team team tournament. The soccer showpiece will return to the United States for the first time since the 1994 after beating out Morocco 134 votes to 65 at the FIFA Congress in Moscow. The U.S. proposed hosting 60 out of the 80 games in 2026, when 16 teams will be added to the finals, meaning that Canada and Mexico will have 10 matches apiece. But before all that happens, there's the 2018 FIFA World Cup. 8 years after it was awarded the right to host the Football World Cup, Russia says it is ready for kickoff in the month-long competition. But with the total World Cup budget having been increased no less than 12 times and allegations of corruption surrounding stadium construction, how ready is Russia to host one of the world's biggest sporting competitions? Henry Ridgewell has that story.
Forget the politics and protests. For these young Russians, the World Cup is about one thing only, football.
I am absolutely thrilled because the World Cup is being held in Russia. I would like our national team to reach at least the quarterfinal and ideally win the World Cup.
That may be a little too much to hope for. But the visit of soccer superstars like Lionel Messi and Cristiano Ronaldo has set many young hearts racing.
Because they are famous and they invented so many tricks.
Dmitry Kolnov heads the soccer school in the outskirts of Moscow.
There is a golden phrase, sport is beyond politics. I very much want to believe that people throughout the world feel the same way.
There are plenty who disagree. The cost of hosting this World Cup is estimated at about $14 billion, the most expensive ever in a country with huge wealth inequality. That money has bought new infrastructure and several huge stadiums. St. Petersburg's Krestovsky Arena was completed 8 years behind schedule and four times over budget. A local official was charged with taking a $351,000 bribe during construction. City authorities say the end result is worth it.
From my point of view, it's the best European stadium at the moment.
Nizhny Novgorod, the birthplace of writer Maxim Gorky, has a new 45,000-seat stadium.
There are not 40,000 soccer fans in Nizhny Novgorod. There is no real soccer team either. Why do we need a stadium like this?
The World Cup organising body, FIFA, itself mired in historical corruption cases, has praised Russia's preparations. Sports journalist Alexei Matveev says FIFA has willfully ignored rampant criminality.
Corruption in football, theft, even outright murder in the field of sports, none of these are investigated. I mean, that is just the Russian reality. Nobody here does anything. I'm still quite amazed, if not outraged, about how it was possible to give the World Cup to Russia with such a corrupt football industry.
Moscow rejects such accusations and hopes the politics will be forgotten after the opening kickoff Thursday, when the hosts take on Saudi Arabia in Moscow's Luzhniki Stadium, watched over by Russian President Vladimir Putin. With so much economic and political capital invested, the Kremlin is banking on a successful tournament. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
And one final note today. Back in 1978, the movie musical Grease, starring John Travolta and Olivia Newton-John, had its world movie premiere in New York. The title track, Grease, was written by Barry Gibb of the Bee Gees fame and was sung by Frankie Valli. It sold over 7 million copies around the globe and was featured twice on the motion picture soundtrack, once as the opening number and, of course, a second time as a closing reprise. Other songs from the movie musical that went on to be hits include the duet Summer Nights, You're the One That I Want, and We Go Together. But as Frankie sings, Grease is the word. Can you believe it? 40 years. 40 years of Grease. Patrice Martin directed today's program, and Sule Terawale engineered the broadcast. Thank you to you both. But before I go, thank you for spending part of your day with us. If you haven't yet, please follow the Voice of America on social media, where we post pictures, videos, stories, and more. You'll find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. That's going to do it for me today. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a wonderful Wednesday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
As required by the U.S. Congress, the United States Department of State released the 2017 International Religious Freedom Report in May, acknowledging the commitment of the government of the Gambia towards religious freedom and tolerance. In January 2017, President Adama Barrow announced the country's return to a secular republic as prescribed in the Constitution, overturning a decree by former President Yahya Jammeh that proclaimed the country an Islamic state. On several occasions, President Barrow stressed the need for continued religious freedom and tolerance, and in February 2017, he appointed a special advisor to the president for religious and traditional affairs. The president called for continued religious tolerance between Christians and Muslims in the region on various occasions, such as during a meeting with Archbishop Benjamin Ndiaye of Dakar in August 2017. President Barrow also linked religious freedom and tolerance to investor confidence. In May 2017, Minister of Agriculture Omar Jallo promised the Ahmadiyya Muslim Jamaat community full government protection. The Gambian Constitution provides for the freedom of religious choice, as long as doing so does not impinge on the rights of others or the national interest. It prohibits regional discrimination, establishment of a state religion, and formation of political parties based on religious affiliation. Interfaith marriage remained common and accepted. There were continued tensions between the majority Sunni Muslim community and the Ahmadiyya Muslim community. The Supreme Islamic Council, a religious council tasked with providing Islamic religious guidance, continued to state that the Ahmadiyya community did not belong to Islam, and it did not include members of the community in its events and activities. Ahmadi Muslims stated that they were part of Islam and thus should be fully integrated within the Muslim community. The government largely did not become involved in the disagreement between the two communities. At the four iftars held by the embassy during Ramadan this year, the ambassador reminded officials and religious and community leaders of their roles in promoting religious freedom.